Let's do this, the Cult of Hockey podcast. By the faithful and for the faithful, I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David.
How are you doing?
Well, you know, it's April 30th, and I got my taxes done yesterday, so I got the day off. I usually have to spend this day
pulling your hair out.
So today I'm enjoying the blue sky on a Monday and thinking, well, that was one job done and on time and under budget. So we're all smiling. It is, unfortunately, the also April 30th, in addition to being tax day, is also the anniversary of Steve Smith's famous gaffe. And it is, in fact, also Steve Smith's birthday.
Oh, jeez.
55 today, and that gaffe happened on his 23rd birthday, and 32 years later, it still stings. Man, oh man, that was a tough game to take.
After that, do you remember that Bob Johnson, he boasted, I guess is the best word, or mentioned, boasted, it was seven secrets for beating the Oilers?
Seven-point plan, yeah,
yes,
I sure do.
Seven-point plan, and about a year later, or sometime later, I always wonder what it was. And he actually detailed it with me. I went down to Calgary and I did a profile of Bob Johnson for the Journal. And he went through the 7-point plan, what they were. And they were essentially,
that was interesting.
It was very interesting. And essentially what they were was a long list of how to interfere with people. Various ways of interfering with people, as I recall. That's my recollection. I don't have the list in front of me, but that's what I remember it was.
Did he have Cliff Fletcher's change the rules of the NHL to get the 4x4 out of it on the list, or was that a fait accompli by then?
Yeah, I think that
rankles me still as well. Remember 85, the Oilers were so good at 4-on-4 that they legislated coincidental penalties out. And it was Cliff Fletcher leading the charge. And then in 85, 86, that was the year of Calgary. And anytime there was a coincidental penalty, I would make a point of looking on the ice and saying, which guy on which team wouldn't be out there if this was a 4-on-4? Always it was a plug. And sometimes it was a goon, you know.
I guess, yeah, those things, it always seems like we get the short end of it. But then I think, like, because I also think of that stupid executive compensation rule, which has cost us.
But then I also think,
Bruce, immediately I think, this is the franchise that also got Wayne Gretzky, blessed with Wayne Gretzky and Connor McDavid. So
this is true.
You know, we've got to just
suck it up.
Yeah, I was going to put shut.
Lately we've been doing
the frack up about our complaints, I guess.
And we've been doing more sucking than sucking it up. But
have we ever.
It's time to turn the page on that also. So what do we got?
And a key ingredient, Bruce, in doing that, you know, one of the interesting assets is the Oilers' 10th overall draft pick. The draft lottery was held. The Oilers ended up drafting 10th. I was, you know, hoping that they would end up higher than that. I was relieved that they didn't end up a few points lower, because by all accounts, it does look like there's about 9 to 10 consensus players who are showing up in most of the lists. And it's usually about 9 to 10, I think is about right. And so they are, I'll just go down Bob McKenzie's list real quick. Bruce, Rasmus Dahlin, Andrei Svechnikov, Philip Zadina, Brady Tkachuk, Evan Bouchard, Adam Boakvist, Oliver Wahlstrom, Noah Dobson, Quinton Hughes, Jesperi Kotkaniemi, and Ty Smith. That's 11 players now that I just named. And those are the players that you hear most often, I think. The consensus player. So there was about 11, maybe Joe Valino even might sneak up there. But I think after about 9, I don't, you know, Kotkaniemi and Ty Smith, I think are generally regarded a little bit lower than the 9. So it looks like the Oilers and the good news, Bruce, in that list are 3 right shot defensemen and another one, Ty Smith, who plays the right side. So in terms of the ongoing organizational need and likely to be an organizational need into the future, there's 4 of those guys in this draft. So when the Oilers are drafting, there's likely to be one of them. And I don't know about any of these players. I've been watching this under 18 thing from, is it Magnitogorsk? Because that's where it's at. And I've seen now Ty Smith and Bulkfist played. And I'll tell you what, neither of them, the mm-hmm. one that my first introduction to another player was very good. Yes. They didn't have good games, either of them. Bulkfist has a really great shot. And man, can he handle the puck?
He also has a concussion.
I didn't see that that game yet. I've taped them all, and I'm going to be watching them. So that's, which is bad. You know, that could affect his draft position. Concussions are obviously. Yeah. So I don't know. Like
anyway, that's the story, and nobody knows for sure. He just finished his tourney was over, and.
Well, maybe was it suggesting he played with one, or I guess not. You're not allowed to.
I don't think so. I just think that's what ended his tournament. And I didn't see the game in which it happened either. So anyway, the bad news about McKenzie's list, though, and remember the Oilers dropped one spot from 9 to 10.
Yeah.
And he says, well, there was a bit of separation between the top 8 down to number 9, Quinton Hughes. Understand one thing about this year's draft, McKenzie says. Based on our survey, there is a huge drop-off in consensus after number 9. Wouldn't you know?
Well, but you can always count on, usually, can't you? Usually count on someone going off, you know, off kilter and taking someone that's not expected.
Going off the board, yeah.
Some people,
someone will take a Jesse Ninimaki or something, right?
Well, Kotkaniemi was rated by Button really high. I think it was by Button really highly, and so you never. And Ty Smith has been related. Low Tide has him at Alan Mitchell.
Low Tide loves him. He has him at number 5.
Yeah,
and he's a big fan of Ty Smith.
So there's always someone who's going to, you know, probably probably one of those guys in the top 9, if they really are, would be there for the Oilers, I'm guessing. You know, I think that's usually the way it works out. So how long whether any of those players, because usually if you look at the history of the draft in terms of people who become significant NHL players, after the first two or three players, there's a massive drop off historically. And in terms of becomes really an NHL star and who doesn't. So the Oilers are, you know, historically would be unlikely to get a star player. You know, it's about maybe, I don't know, 1 out of 3 players taken at that level. It's just off the top of my head. Have looked into this a few times. 1 out of 3, I think, is maybe 2 out of 3 they'll get a NHL player. And then 1 out of 3 they'll get a dud. It's the truth. Someone will never make it.
Well, the last time they had number 10, they took Magnus Pajärvi. And I'll let you decide whether he's an NHL player or a dud. But he's certainly not a star.
He's somewhere in between that, right? I think it's fair to say he has played in the NHL, and I think he was in the NHL this past year. Did he get waived this past year again? I think
he did. Yeah, and he wound up going to a different team. And of course, he did get the opportunity almost right away. Like while still a teenager, he came in and played 80 NHL games, and it didn't necessarily. Say it didn't prove he was ready, and I'm not sure it helped his overall development at all. But point being, usually when you get a guy at number 10, you're going to have to wait a couple of years before you see much out of that guy, with rare exceptions.
Yeah, it is kind of exciting. The one thing that is exciting is there are all these, to me, the right shot D-men, who, you know, that is a huge organizational need. You can't hope to fill it in the short term, and obviously, but that's not going away. So unless Ethan Bear just totally keeps rocketing up, that's what it would take for that need to essentially dissipate somewhat. But Bruce, I think the most likely thing that we're hearing about is, Charlie's mentioned this, is trading that pick. What do you think of that?
Well, that's I guess where I was going with the previous comment about how you're going to have to wait a while for that pick. And that is, how patient are the Oilers to wait a while for another high draft pick to come around? Consider that picking outside of the top 5, even they went number 7 in 2013 when they picked Darnell Nurse. Did not blow the pick. They got a real solid pick at number 7. And here we are 5 years later, and he's really still sort of, making his, he's still blossoming as a player. Like, it takes time. And there's very few guys that are going to come in and make a difference right away. And almost none of them are down as low as number 10.
No, you'd have to get really lucky, essentially, for that to happen. And it does happen now and then, but you have to get lucky for that to happen. So trading the pick, I've been in favor of trading the pick because, you know, there's this idea that McDavid's young and Drysdale's young and you got to win now. And then I kind of, like, as I thought more about the coming expansion draft and problems that might come protecting the player that you trade for, plus just, you know, what is the best plan in the NHL? You know, is it, they don't have the cap space. So if they trade, they're going to have to move salary. I mean, if you're trading, you're not just trading the first pick and bringing in, let's say, Justin Falk from Carolina. He's got, what, a $4 million contract? Yeah. You got to move someone then. You got to move Oscar Clefbaum. So it's not, it doesn't just work that way where you could trade the pick and bring in salary. You'd have to move salary, which is hard to do. So I'm leaning increasingly to the, because of the salary cap considerations, because of the expansion draft, you got to keep the pick. And the other, I think Peter Chiarelli he's got a long-term vision. I think that's just how he's oriented. I don't think he would make short-term moves. And in fact, that he didn't bring in veterans at the trade deadline in 2016-17, and that he didn't bring in veterans this year, and he decided to go with Nurse, Benning, Kajula, indicates to me someone who is willing to go with young players and develop young players and has that really on his mind a lot. But you'd have to think, Bruce, that there's a temptation to win now, right now, for both Chiarelli and McLellan, and pressure to trade that pick for their own. They have to fight against a conflict, what is a conflict of interest in my view, to save their own jobs by trying to improve the team right now by giving up futures. And I'm in no way, I'm suggesting that Chiarelli would give into that temptation, but there's that conflict going on. It exists. It's real. I think, do you think he would, what do you think, how would he factor that?
Yeah, it's a tough call. You know, I mean, one of the strengths that the Oilers have right now, I think, is in their drafting.
And yes.
When you look at Keith Gretzky's record in Boston, you know, I mean, he drafted David Pastrnak, number 25 overall in the first round. That guy's a stud. Yeah.
Louis DeBrusque.
In the last year,
Jake DeBrusque.
Well, they had the three in a row, and the two guys are still a long way out. But Jake DeBrusque came in and was good in the NHL right away. And then 16, and I'm not sure how the scouting structure changed in Boston after Chiarelli left. But Charlie McAvoy, first round pick, 14 overall, and a year of college hockey later, he came into the NHL and he was a star. He's probably going to be on the all rookie team and looks to be a long term defensive stud. So you trade a guy like that, and I mean, from an Oilers perspective, you look in the rear view at the first round pick from the 2015 draft that got traded away, and that guy now starring in the NHL, or the guy that got picked with the pick, starring in the NHL, you damn well better get a good player back. If you get a dud in return, man, that's a killer. That is just a killer, and it killed that trade. Really did hurt.
Because here's the issue. Let's say you only have let's say I was right in that. And it's a 1 in 3 chance of getting a star with the top with the 10th pick. You still have a chance of getting a star, right? That's the whole idea. You need stars to win. You need these outstanding players. So even though you might miss, and in trading the pick, are you going to get a star? So you're not going to get a star player because it doesn't have that value. You'd have to package up the pick with something else to get a star. Yes. So I think the trade to work for the Oilers, they have got to move salary anyway. They're going to have to create cap space, move that pick, and get back a star player, someone who's at least a top four defenseman, or at least a top six forward, in return for a players and that draft pick. That's the trade that would make sense for the Oilers. And if Chiarelli can pull that off, I think people will be satisfied here in Edmonton. If it's just the pick for a kind of a more, you know, margin, like an average NHL player, that, I think that would be a disaster, honestly. Like you can get average NHL players all kinds of different ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, would they be able to, for instance, turn that pick into an Ekman Larson, right? With other things, with Clefbaum, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the fellows on the radio this morning, possibly Tyler Yaremchuk, but on TSN 1260, was talking about recent trades. of draft picks around 8, 9, 10. And in each case, the pot had to be sweetened with other players to get a player back, with one example being Pittsburgh Penguins trading Jordan Staal, and they got back the number 8 draft pick, and they got back the Sutter, Brandon Sutter, whichever one. Mm-hmm. One is in Vancouver now. He gave a couple other examples where two good young players and the pick got moved in return for a star player. I think Bobby Ryan, can you imagine? And he went for two guys that are now regulars in the NHL plus a top 10 draft pick.
Yeah, so it would be like the pick and Kyler Yamamoto for and maybe something, maybe like a salary as well for Oliver Ekman-Larsson. So it starts to get to be a pretty nasty price to pay. So, but it's the one obvious thing to move. To me, like, if you're not moving Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and you can't move, you can't move Milan Lucic, Andre Sekera, it'd be very Chris Russell, if you wanted to move him, it'd be very difficult because of his no movement contract. Who are you going to move? Like, it comes down to the first pick in Oscar Klefbom in terms of being, and Jesse Puljujärvi in terms of being assets with value that you're going to move. And you'd be trading low on two of them, Klefbom or Puljujärvi. And of course, no one wants to trade high on Nugent Hopkins. So it's could be a pretty quiet summer, Bruce.
Yeah. And there's, you know, the trade market isn't exactly, I don't think, teeming with candidates. Sometimes, some years you get, Craig McTavish used to talk about at the end of the first round, you'd have 8 more pissed off GMs in the pool of potential trade candidates. But this year, the first round, I don't think it actually produced many upsets. And I'm not sure there's too many teams that are just saying, oh, rip that up, that didn't work. But maybe the teams that were already out of the playoffs are the better target, because there's a few horror stories there, Edmonton just being one of them.
What was the trade last year? I'm just going to Google it. Stepan went to Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Eric Stepan and Antti Raanta. Mm-hmm. So that was actually Raanta. Didn't he have a good year? Seventh pick. Uh-huh. And right-handed defenseman Anthony D'Angelo. Uh-huh. For Antti Raanta and Derek Stepan. I think that if the Coyotes would not do that trade again today.
I think.
Would be my guess. No, I don't. Did Stepan work out?
They're not bad players that they got. I'm just looking up the Bobby Ryan trade, which was along the same ilk. And Bobby Ryan, I'm not sure that did. Traded to Ottawa by Anaheim for Jacob Silfverberg, Stefan Nosen, and Ottawa's first round pick in 2014 draft. And I think that was like a 10th overall pick, if I recall.
But it's so colored by how bad a player Bobby Ryan has become. And this is, of course, the danger of getting veteran players, is you might be trading for someone like this idea of trading for Max Pacioretty. I just think, like, seriously, he's really near the end of his prime scoring years. He's already trending down a bit, or he did this year. Mm-hmm. If that's the kind of answer that they come up with, I don't like that answer at all. The interesting player that they like, so I always play, of course, pay close attention to what Bob Stauffer says, because he works for the Oilers and may be privy to information that others are not. And he was floating the name of mm-hmm. Justin Falk, a name that's been floated a lot with Carolina. You know, they have a lot of defensemen. And Falk had a really bad year.
Yeah, tell me about it. I had him in my pool.
So he's a hell of a power player. Mm-hmm. He has been. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of player that. But it shouldn't take the 10th pick in the draft to get you Justin Falk. Although maybe that would be the price. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be the kind of trade that they'd be looking at. But again, you have to shed salary to bring him in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to lose him in the expansion draft, probably.
Well, that's the other thing that's a factor. That's the thing that, you know, totally burned the Oilers in the Griffin-Reinhardt deal. Although in the end, after the way Reinhardt fared after the expansion draft, you could say much ado about nothing. But the fact is that had the Oilers kept the picks, they would have had not had to protect them in the expansion draft, whereas the asset they did get for those picks was the one they had to protect and couldn't. And so
it's kind of exhibit A for how those it's exhibit A for how this kind of trade can go wrong, right? Yeah. You couldn't have a better. It's right in our face. But I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for Oilers fans actually to trade that pick. Mm-hmm. That's what I sense. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's how I'm seeing it. Mm-hmm. Klefbom has a lot of hardcore fans, and we all like him, but he's got really fervent supporters, and Nugent Hopkins, mm-hmm. of course, no one wants, and Puljujarvi. I'm in the camp of super enthusiastic about that player and hope he can mm-hmm. turn it around here. So he's
definitely
good luck, Shirelli. Shirelli's gonna definitely piss people off whatever he does.
A trade possibility of Puljujarvi. He's a long way from being immune from being traded, in my view. I mean, I want to see him stick it out here and develop into the talented player we've seen flashes of, but.
He was 19 this year, and according to the work that Jonathan and Willis and myself mm-hmm. and you did, Bruce, he was their second best winger, two-way winger when you worked it all out on scoring chances mm-hmm. plus minus, after mm-hmm. Patrick Maroon. So it's not like he was even just in the pecking order this year. He didn't get all the chance. He never got any much power play time, and it's certainly not on the left faceoff circle where he's best used. But just let's have some patience with that player. And I think that's definitely Shirelli's opinion of the player. That's the strong sense I get. Bruce, mm-hmm. let's move on to Shirelli, because he talked to Bob Stoilers of the Oilers organization about the McClellan signing or the McClellan confirmation hearing. Right. That Todd McClellan was they're going to keep him after all, Bruce. So I'll read you the money quote, because for the first time here, Shirelli, he effusively praised McClellan, but he also took responsibility himself for what went wrong. And he said, Todd is an innovative guy. He's a communicator, and he's a very good coach in what he's done before, what he's done last year for us, and even in year one. I'm not absolving myself in any of this, because I have to be better in providing him players. But he's too good a coach not to keep. He's got a lot of good qualities, and we can all improve, and we're going to do that. So what I focused on, Bruce, was I'm not absolving myself because I didn't provide him enough players. And I don't – in Shirelli's first press conference, I don't remember him saying anything close to that, whereas McClellan came out with, I'm going to be looking myself in the mirror. And I'm the head coach, of course, I'm responsible. So he took a page out of the McClellan book there.
Yeah, I remember it slightly different. What he didn't do in the presser was he didn't really – he said those things, but he kind of blew right past them into the rest of the problems without sort of stopping and saying, I'm looking in the mirror at myself first and foremost, period. Paragraph break. No, our coaching and players also had a tough year. It was like he just sort of rolled right on into it. And he did sort of in a mealy mouth kind of way. I found in the press situation, some days he's really good and other days he kind of stumbles on his words a little bit. Like, here's what he said. He was asked, was the club's failure on players or management? And his specific quote was, I'm certainly trying to be accountable here, but the players, I think, but for two or three, the players as a group, their performances were subpar. I'm not saying my performance was above par. That's the full quote. So he did kind of circle back on himself, but he didn't stop there for long.
Okay. So I can see why I thought that he didn't take responsibility. You've confirmed my belief that he did not properly kind of take some responsibility. And I think he did that much better job of it in that.
Yeah, no, he just chose he coined his words better, or at least he made more of the focal point that.
Yeah, well, enough people had said, hey, buddy, why didn't you take more responsibility? And he listened to them.
This is your team, you better own it.
Yeah, and he also praised the other thing that he did this time was he really praised the coach. Yeah. And he didn't do that the first time around. And I think the idea that McClellan's job was in jeopardy, I think, was always a bit of a charade mm-hmm. in retrospect. I don't think that was ever on the table. I think that's pretty clear now, you know, from the praise that we're hearing right now from Shirelli. And I think what was going on then when Shirelli was pretty negative about mm-hmm. the team and the players and implicitly about the mm-hmm. coaching was he was getting the fan base ready for, you know, axing all the assistant yep. coaches and maybe, hey, you know, sending a little message to McClellan, like, this is real, this is happening. Like, although I don't know if this, maybe they're always on the same, maybe they were on the same page about axing the assistant coaches from the start. But I one of the thoughts I had is that he's trying to sell to McClellan, like, come on, buddy, we are making major changes here and they are needed. And this is happening. This is real. And you're going to have to, we got to make some really tough decisions about people that we're friends with.
Right. Well, to circle back again to what he said at the end of the season press conference, he was asked about the coaching staff's future. And he said, I'm yeah. doing the evaluation of the coaches. After this season, they're under close scrutinization. I have to look real close at it. I have to dig deep and can't say with certainty, but on the surface, you'd think, yes, I have to make some changes. I'll leave it at that. I want to make sure that we look at every facet of the coaching staff. Obviously, I have to look at special teams. I have to look at the personnel they were given, which is a mea culpa of a sort. I have to look at how they were handled adversity through the year as far as system changes or personnel changes. So I got to dig deep. And my takeaway on that day and subsequently in that same post was that McClellan was in solid, but one or more of the assistants are gone. And of course, that is basically all yeah. of the assistants, with the exception, I guess, of Dustin Schwartz, whose name hasn't been whispered at any point, really.
Yeah, it sounds like he's sticking around. I heard Stauffer address it briefly, and it sounded like they were saying so. Mm-hmm. So Shirelli was engaged in scrutinization, Bruce. You always know if a GM is involved in scrutinization yeah. as opposed to scrutiny, that he's definitely on the right path.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he's like five syllables deep where only three were required.
That's the level of care they took. They let no syllable remain uncovered.
So he basically did what he said he was going to do. He did his scrutinization. He did change out the coaching team. And, you know, and in a significant way, I mean, they canned four coaches
here. Yes, they did.
When you count the minor league team, and they reassigned the one guy, Jay Woodcroft. I'm hearing lots of people saying, well, what the hell has Jay Woodcroft ever done? You know, why would they have him down there screwing up our development system instead? And I'm thinking, I don't mind Jay Woodcroft as a hire at all. Like, he's got outstanding qualifications. 13 years as an assistant coach in the NHL. And on mostly pretty good programs, and he's going to take a crack at being a head coach.
Plus a reputation.
Where are you going to find a better qualified minor league coach? I mean, you're not going to go out and get Bruce Boudreau to coach your minor league team, right?
That doesn't happen. I mean, they could have brought in a Western Hockey League coach with a lot of success and gone that route, because mm-hmm. that's certainly happened a lot. And, you know, that person would have more experience as a head coach, which is the job.
Right.
But you know, Woodcroft has a reputation for being good at working one-on-one with skill development with mm-hmm. players. That's mm-hmm. absolutely crucial at that level of play, that you have a master at that. And he can also bring in specialists, and hopefully they will like have that real focus. I think it's five coaches because they fired Bruce because they fired the assistant in.
They fired Jim Johnson, Ian Herbers, Jerry Fleming, and I forgot.
Bokeforce.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, yeah. So
they kept
Woodcroft. I guess.
They kept J.F. Hoole, and they kind of kept Woodcroft. They didn't fire him.
Yeah, he didn't get fired. Yeah, fair enough. You're right.
But on the plus side of it, he's worked with Todd McClellan for all of those 13 years. And if they're going to now be the head coaches on the different levels within the organization, they need to be on the exact same wavelength. And I don't see why they wouldn't be. In terms of a guy comes up from Bakersfield, he should be prepared to play Todd McClellan's style of hockey. That's going to be hardwired in Woodcroft. And it's also in his best interest, you know, and in the organization's best interest that they're doing the same things.
So I guess, Connor McDavid was named today team captain of Team Canada at the Worlds, which is another really good experience for him to take on that leadership and lead that team over there. That's excellent. He was also asked about the Hart Trophy voting, Bruce. What did he have to say?
The clip I saw was 23 seconds of Connor saying not very much, which is a pretty standard quote from Connor, saying there's a lot of different ways I could have gone, a lot of different choices. And he was said nice things about the three candidates that did that are the so-called finalists. Of course, the vote has been fully conducted and they know who number one is, but they announced the top three. And you could almost kind of see the fire burning below the eyes, and you know, but he didn't say anything but the right stuff and really mostly nothing.
You know, Bruce, I think this was just a really weird MVP vote, honestly. Yeah. I don't think they came close to getting the right three finalists. I mean, they came close because the players they picked would have been, I think, like on my list in the top eight or nine.
Hall, McKinnon, and Kopitar, yeah.
Yeah, I would have had McKinnon about fourth, Hall sixth, and Kopitar seventh because I actually did my own list.
Oh, did you?
But I think that the writers, honestly, and this is a really human thing, I think they got swept up in the narrative of those teams and those players. Mm-hmm. And what really – and in the and then they kind of – they took the definition for the MVP and they kind of tried to fit it into this
right.
to this narrative. And so the narrative is like it's a really great player without a ton of support on a mediocre team. Yep, and through his individual efforts, he takes that team and gets it into the playoff almost all on his own. And that's for Hall and McKinnon. Those are really compelling stories this year. And I can see why people are excited about that. But to me, the most valuable player by definition is the best player. And he's the one who really is most valuable to his team. Whatever team he's on, the best player in the league is always the best. He's the best player. He's the most valuable player. If he was sold on the open market for money, he would command by far the most money. If he was traded, he would command by far the most in trade value. And any other definition, I just think is this kind of weird gymnastic stretch where you're trying to figure out, well, we can't give it to the best player, even if he is the best player on a really bad team, because he without him on that team, well, that team would have still been a bad team. But we also can't give it to the great players like Malkin and Kucherov on the best teams because there's other really good players on those teams. So it's almost like who your teammates are decide uh-huh. whether you can win that award or not. And that is uh-huh. ridiculous, Bruce, I think. Uh-huh.
Consider this, David, that all three of the MVP candidates played on wild card teams. So that's literally, it's a band of four teams between 13 and 16 in the overall standings. They're not among the 15 that missed the playoffs because their seasons were by definition worthless if the team didn't make the playoffs by this definition. And as you say, anybody on a really good team, well, he had too much support. The first question is, did the team make the playoffs? Nope, out. Second question, would his team have made the playoffs without him? Yes, out. What's left? and it's just trying to make what should be a few hours of work and winnow it down into a five-minute weed them out procedure and see what's left. And basically, they got three good players that certainly made big differences on their team. But whether they got the best players, well, that's a very...
It's kind of an award for lead actor on the most compelling narrative of the year award this year. That's
the coach of the year is, you know, like there's many of these awards. They have these sort of shorthand. Coach of the year is the coach whose team improved the most from last year, right? And we got the guy in Vegas, the guy in Colorado, and I think the guy in Boston. Is that right? I'm trying to remember from last week.
Yeah, I didn't even pay attention.
And
to that.
And I've talked to you about this before, and I might be the only person that cares about the Masterton Trophy having evolved into a comeback player of the year award, which is not anywhere in the wording of the trophy, but that's what it is. And so all of these things have become twisted. And just to go to your point of most valuable, who draw the most in the trade, Sidney Crosby, he's only won the MVP award twice. So this is not just a this year thing of best player getting overlooked. I mean, they do go off of, you know, specifically what happened within the season. But I think there's way too much emphasis on playoffs. To me, this is a regular season award. So vote on what happened in the regular season, not as if the regular season had only one function, which is to determine the postseason.
Well, that's it, and the kind of the I think the ill-advised thinking was shown up in the first round of the playoffs when all three of those teams were dumped rather rapidly. LA, yeah, New Jersey, and Colorado, three games between them. So, so Bruce, I did a process where I just tried to have an objective way to do it, and like you say, it should be like a two-hour process to come up with based, and then also based on your viewings of each of these players this year. And I just looked at like total points, points per game. Special teams points, even strength points, even strength plus minus, even strength plus minus relative to team, percentage of the team's goals that you're in on. I also gave a mark for how the team, how your team did overall, like, you know, just how many points they got. And then I did a ranking of what I thought of them as defensive players. So I just tried to come up with what as objective as I could a measurement of what we can measure for these players. And so based on that, my list was McDavid winning and quite handily. He was quite a bit ahead of anyone else. Then it was fairly close with Giroux and Malkin being the next two choices. And they were, again, in their own group. And then there was a group of three players, McKinnon, Kucherov, and Hall, and then Kopitar and Wheeler. So
yeah, well, that's, that would have been my list. They're all good players, and certainly was a main player competition this year. So this business of sort of sorting them into categories wound up really being the difference maker. I'm extremely keen to see not just the breakdown of votes this year, which we get every year in terms of the numbers of first, second, third place votes, but they're actually going to, for the first time ever this year, be transparent in who voted for what. And I'm just interested to see if there's any sort of established patterns or biases that are readily identified there.
It'll be interesting to see who voted for McDavid, for instance. I mean, that if anyone
voted at all for McDavid,
or who didn't vote at all for him, that would be it'll be fun. Another, of course, we'll have another podcast on that when it happens. Let's end up, Bruce.
He'll have a million fifth place votes just so that he would be on the ballot, but not really getting any points. But that's just my guess. He'll have a lot of fourth and fifth place votes, and not enough in the top three, obviously.
So Matt Hendricks, Bruce, he didn't get into any playoff games last year on the Oilers because he was not, frankly, up to snuff as a hockey player. So the legend of Matt Hendricks, Bruce, is way hardcore.
Where did you?
It is way hardcore. It's like he, even though his presence on the team on the Oilers in 3 or 4 years before that didn't turn a crappy team into a playoff team. In 2016-17, it did. And then they missed. Yeah, that's where to believe. And that, and I don't discount the fact that he is an absolutely outstanding human being, but he was not an NHL player in his last year in Edmonton, and arguably wasn't one before then. He was, but by his last year, he was on his last legs. But Winnipeg got him, and they turned it around. So the narrative again is that he was a huge part of that. Maybe he is somehow this magic elixir. Although again, it didn't work in Edmonton the years prior to that. But last, he gets into a playoff game, and I don't want to pick on him too much because all kinds of players make mistakes at all. Hockey is a game of mistakes, and it's easy to make them. But man, the mistake he made on the winning overtime goal, it's not the kind of player that they play. Like it doesn't go with the veteran leader narrative. When the other team's on the attack and you shift off the ice and it helps lead to an Ironman rush and a goal against.
Yeah. He looked over his shoulder, he saw what was going on, and he just cruised off to the bench. And the odd man rush, I mean, a hard hustling back check. I need to check and see how long his shift was, but a hard hustling back check there. And that 2-on-1 is probably a 2-on-2. And obviously a very different game, a very different story. And I'm just looking, I mean, it was double overtime. People were starting to make mistakes out there. Last night, I mean, in the nine, almost, 85 minutes of hockey, Hendricks played 9 minutes and 37 seconds.
So it's opportunistic of me to pick on this narrative right now after he makes a big mistake. Mm-hmm. But I acknowledge that. Yep. Nonetheless, that narrative, I think it's true. Yeah, you got me. But nonetheless, that narrative, I think it can be overstated, is my take on it. Because again, he had been on the Oilers all those years, and there was no, you know, maybe on a team that's totally stacked And maybe you have room for that kind of guy. And maybe that kind of guy on a totally stacked team is really valuable. And maybe on certain kinds of teams, he's really valuable. I don't know. That could be. I'm not going to say he's not.
Well, Winnipeg's pretty stacked.
They are. And so are the Oilers last year, I guess, somewhat. But
anyway, Hendricks also took two penalties last night, and one of them on the play that they scored, and it was knocked off the board. So he had a pretty tough night in not very much time. And I read a few tweets from Winnipeg supporters that sounded exactly like some of the counter-Hendricks narrative supporters in Edmonton talking about his grititude and that sort of, specifically in response to a little video somebody posted of his poor line change on the game winner. And a lot of people fervently hoping that Matthew Perreault was ready to return to the lineup next game, or they had somebody else in mind, but that this was the wrong time to be going with a guy that can't keep up anymore. And I just thought, I've read all this stuff before. I remember that time in Buffalo last year when Hendricks didn't get out to the point to block the shot on with the goalie out that cost the Oilers a lead and eventually a game. You know, and guys, no matter how wonderful people they are, no matter how gritty they are, mistakes still happen, and you have to evaluate.
Yeah,
you have to evaluate based on the whole thing. And he's now, what, 36 years old? He'll be 37 in a couple of months, and at the end of the line for sure.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to defend the Oilers' decision to not to play him in the playoffs last year, and to say goodbye. It was time to say goodbye. I think they made the right call. And even in retrospect of what happened, I don't think that was the issue, honestly. I think it was, there's so many other huge, massive performance issues, you know, Sekera mm-hmm. being hurt, and Talbot being hurt and playing poorly on the top of that list.
The biggest issue with Hendricks was that Hendricks left, Lander left, Pouliot left, and collectively they didn't bring in any real penalty killers to enough. So that was, that was a roster thing where they just didn't fill the need. I'm not sure Hendricks, if we'd have had him this year, he would have made, sorry, I'm just saying, I don't know if they had Hendricks this year, he would have made that big of a difference on the penalty kill. But my overall point is they just didn't, they didn't cover off what became a weak suit in the lineup.
Or they had the players and they didn't use them in Ryan Strome. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah, the one guy.
All right, let's leave it there, Bruce. That's right. 43 minutes. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Tomorrow, May 1st, we'll probably hear about Koskinen, eh? And it sounds like he's in the bank, and it's just a matter of the Russian contracts, the KHL contracts expire today. And May Day is to them what Canada Day is to us. You know, it's a free agent frenzy. I'm sure they have KHL TV in 13 time zones, all talking about all the free agents that are going to Magnitogorsk and Edmonton. Well, hopefully Edmonton. Well, I won't say hopefully, but probably from the sounds of it, Edmonton getting a player, and we can talk about his merits once he's in. Once we know what the number is, that's the big question. How much?
Thanks again, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.